Good afternoon, everybody. I enjoyed the opening prayer. You always have to be careful anything you say about the prayers, because I remember in Wyoming once at Spokesman Club, where we were learning how to give prayers, the pastor evaluated the opening prayer and had some criticisms of it. And the man who gave the prayer was a tax evading rancher. And he said, "I wasn't talking to you." And and he had a point. But I think I heard Frank say, and of course I don't hear that well when my glasses are fogged up, but I think I heard him say that we're aliens looking for a place to be. And that sums up the existence of God's family these days in a phrase. I really appreciated that. We have quite a mixture of people in the church anymore. We have people who've been around for 150 years, and we have people who are learning things new. And one of the things that people may not be aware of, the old timers will know this, but it just doesn't come up that much anymore, but it's in the Bible. It's in Numbers 9, and there's a story there. I'm not going to read the story, but it's the origins of the second Passover. If there are circumstances where you miss the first Passover, there are provisions made for you to take a second Passover. And back in the days when we had hundreds and hundreds of people in the church, it wasn't uncommon. I think every year I was at someone's house helping them observe the second Passover, because people would either be sick or something would happen. God says in Numbers 9 that you should strive absolutely to keep the first Passover, but he acknowledged that things happen. And there are provisions for that. I don't know if people even know that anymore. Interesting, though, that it's for the Passover and not for any of the other festivals. The other festivals don't have redos. Can you imagine a second week of unleavened bread? Well, I think people did that once in history, but certainly not atonement. Nobody wants a second atonement. It's nobody's favorite day. Well, you lucky people, I am declaring today second atonement. And during this sermon, I'm asking people not to eat or drink. This includes people at home on Zoom. I know how you Zoomers work, because I have been one, and that just out of sight from the camera, there's often some delicacy on a plate with a fork, and that there is a drink nearby. I have found, while zooming in on Zoom, that nothing improves a sermon like the right drink. It depends on what the drink is, of course. And I'm talking about the person listening, not the person speaking. But you know I'm not serious. As Glinda the Good Witch said to the Wicked Witch of the West, "You have no power here." And I don't actually have the power to declare a second day of atonement. So here's the rule. Here's the rule. You might write it down if you want to. Nobody eat or drink unless you feel like it. That's the rule today. But it is the second day of atonement, because I would like to revisit the day of atonement. I was touched by Mr. Mango's message when he mentioned at the end about his cousin Nikki. Of course, we all were. And but the way he phrased it, and I don't remember, I wish I remembered the exact names, but he said, "As we learned from Paul and David and my cousin Nikki." And it's an interesting juxtaposition, because, of course, we pay attention to the scriptures. They're scriptures, and we learn from them. But just as Mr. Mango said, we learn very poignant, the lessons that we learn from people in what we would call real everyday life, like his cousin, are lessons that grab our hearts. And these lessons about the Day of Atonement come from my heart, and I want to share them with you. It comes from 40 some years of living God's way. And maybe you've had these thoughts too, but I think that these thoughts for me, we've been taught the details and they're all correct. Mr. Thomas gave a very thorough sermon that my wife and I really appreciated on the Day of Atonement, covered the story of the adversary of Satan and his characteristics and how he has played a role throughout God's plan and the events of the Day of Atonement and the events of Leviticus 16 and all the things that are in our articles and our sermons. They're true and they're real and they're accurate. And I don't want to counter any of those. They're right. And you need to know those things to understand the Day of Atonement. But I also feel that there is more, that there are additional ways of looking at the Day of Atonement that not only broaden our understanding of it, but our understanding of God and his plan and our relationship with him. And it would help us throughout the year. It's not just lessons for the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement is a beautiful, poignant day. And I think looking at it this way might help us actually enjoy the day. We probably do now, but observe it not just with endurance, but with purpose and actually look forward to it. The Holy Days, of course, lay out God's plan. The only people who know God's plan, for some strange reason, are the people who keep his Holy Days. When Mr. and Mrs. Herbert Armstrong in the early 20th century started keeping the holy days, they didn't understand why they were keeping them, but they knew that they were instructed to, and so they did, and the understanding came with the keeping. It's a very interesting situation. We keep the holy days and we understand them, and I think, you could discuss it, but I think it's true that the only people who understand God's plan are the people who keep the holy days. And it's one reason we come back to them every year. One reason we're instructed to come back to them every year is we want that ever in our hearts. We want both the rules for keeping them and the reasons for keeping them to be in our heart. We want God's plan always before us. We want that vision ahead of us, like it said in Hebrews that God's people have the vision of the city before them. That's what we want. Other holy days picture steps forward in our journey to become fully God's children. That's what they're about. Let's turn to Leviticus 23, which we rarely do on non-holy days, but just to point out to you that atonement is different from the other holy days. And of course, you know it is because it's the day that we don't eat or drink, but it is different. In Leviticus 23 and verse 26, the Lord said to Moses, "The 10th day of this 7th month is the Day of Atonement. Hold a sacred assembly and deny yourselves." Now, it does not say don't eat or drink, but the Israelites of those days and Moses understood it correctly that we were not to eat or drink, that that's what we were denying ourselves. Hold a sacred assembly and deny yourselves and present an offering made to the Lord by fire. Do no work on this day, because it is the Day of Atonement, when atonement is made for you before the Lord your God. Anyone who does not deny himself on that day must be cut off from his people. There's no second atonement. I will destroy from among his people anyone who does any work on that day. You shall do no work at all. And this is different from the other holy days, understandably, because on other holy days we're allowed to prepare food. We're allowed to do things that help us enjoy the holy day, but on the Day of Atonement, we are to do no work, none at all. It's different. That command is also given for the weekly Sabbath, but it's not given for the other holy days. You shall do no work at all. This is to be a lasting ordinance for the generations to come, wherever you live. It is a Sabbath of rest for you, and you must deny yourselves. Again, not specifically eating or drinking. You must deny yourselves. From the evening of the 9th day of the month until the following evening, you are to observe your Sabbath. Atonement is an interesting word. The Hebrew is Kippur. That's one word that we all know. Yom, the day, Kippur, atonement. But the English word atone, you've heard it explained that it's just short for at one. Now, doesn't that sound scurrilous to you? Doesn't that sound like somebody made that up? Perhaps after a couple glasses of wine or something, they became a dictionary expert, and they decided to tell you that the word atone comes from at and one combined together. Right. Just like people say beatitudes means beautiful attitudes. Well, it kind of does, but it doesn't. At one. Right. Well, guess what? That's where it came from. The word atone comes from at and one. And the meaning of atone is not just cleansing and, drawing you near. It's at one. It means making it at one. As a matter of fact, I have no idea how people know this because there wasn't YouTube back in the 15th century. But linguists say that the word one used to be pronounced differently, that it was on. There wasn't a W in front of it. And actually, I don't know if you can think of one. I couldn't think of any other word that begins with the letter O, where we put a W in front of it and say one. Because if you say one, people think, oh, W-O-N. But in the case of O-N-E, we put a what in front of it. And where on earth did that come from? Well, you know, in other languages, there's un and ein and other things. There's not that thing before it. And it's thought that the word atone actually preserves the old pronunciation of the word one, and that the where the W came from is it's hard to say on after another word. And so that little w crept in between the two. So atone is thought to actually preserve the original pronunciation of at one. I can see you're all as fascinated with this as I am. Let's move on. But it is an interesting word that way. And it gets to the heart of what the Day of Atonement is about. We know the basic story of the events that will take place in the future that atonement pictures are in Revelation 20. And you've had all that. You know that. It's where the bottomless pit, the angel is thrown, locked in. It's only 3 verses long. That's all we have for that particular day. We also get more details in Leviticus 16, where you have the high priest and you have the 2 goats. And we've gone through that thoroughly. Thankfully, I don't have to cover that for time's sake. But you know that directions, specific directions are given on how the Israelites kept the Day of Atonement. We don't do the goats. We read about the goats. We understand the goats. But the sacrifice has been made. We no longer have to do that. But the future, putting the sins on the head, has not been done at this point. And so we still read that and we still understand it. But, you know, that's not something that the people of Israel did. That was something that involved one person who was picturing Jesus Christ, the high priest. And it involves another man who pictures an angel who takes the other goat out into the wilderness. The rest of the people of Israel stood by at that point. And even when the priest went into the Holy of Holies and presented a sacrifice, the other people stood outside and waited for him to come out. There was actually nothing for people to do except not do things, you know, to deny themselves. And denying themselves, traditionally, we don't eat or drink. We don't. You know, people who aren't used to fasting, if they find out you're not eating or drinking. I remember in Montana, I had a friend who was in the church, and he would escape. I didn't understand what the church was about at that point, but he would escape on weekends. On Saturdays, he would disappear. And there were other young people. It was a university town. And I remember there were a couple young women, Chris and Tam, would often come over to the house, and Dave would go away with them. My father was fascinated by that. He said, he has 2 girlfriends? And I said, well, they're just friends, you know, they're just going somewhere to talk or something, because we didn't have services in those days. And I remember my father was there, and I had just baked bread. It had just come out of the oven. The house smelled wonderful. And Tam and Chris are sitting in the front room, and they and Dave are gonna go to the park or something. They're sitting there as demure as possible. And my father's saying, you want some bread? It's fresh out of the oven. And they're going, no. And he said, oh, come on. It's so good. And he took a piece of it and he waved it under their nose. And he said, it's great bread. And they said, no, I don't think so. And my dad said, my son made this bread. And I'm proud of my son. Are you going to turn down this bread? Why are you turning down this bread? And they just have this look. And suddenly, at that point, I remembered reading, because I had read some things about church observance, and I thought, I wonder if this is that day, because those 2 women are being very weird in my front room. I wonder what's going on. And I said, would you like me to wrap up half a loaf and you could take it home? And they said, yes! And we wrapped it up, and they left, and Dave left. I don't think I ever did explain that to my father, but it's when I became aware of the Day of Atonement. We don't eat or drink. The Jews also understand this as we don't take part in sexual relations. Work of any kind is prohibited. Myself personally, on the Day of Atonement, and this is just personal, this isn't a ruling that came to Moses, is I turn off my electronics. No phone, no computer, no iPad, it's all off. Personally, again, I don't play music. I come to services and I will play music before God for his people. I'm very happy to do that. But I don't do it. I don't do any of those things. And we'll talk about that later, because that's, of course, is an individual thing. But what becomes clear about atonement when you think about its role in the whole plan of God is it's the holy day that's not about us. You know, the other ones are about, of course, Jesus and his going through history and doing accomplishing certain things for our benefit. And it talks about God bringing children into his family. And atonement still plays a role in that. It's certainly not out of place in the lineup of holy days, but atonement is the day that's not about us. Passover, of course, our sins are taken away by the sacrifice. Days of Unleavened Bread, we put sin out of our lives. Pentecost, God's family grows because they receive his Holy Spirit. They have Christ in them at that point. They're living God's way with an independent spirit in them that helps them live. We come to the Day of Trumpets, and of course, Jesus Christ returns, but we also change that day. We're changed into spirit beings. God trusts us enough to give us the full spirit experience. And at that point, we have, you know, we've kept the law and lived his way, and he trusts us from that point on. We are spirit beings with the full range of what spirit beings can do. And of course, we all know that the Feast of Tabernacles represents God's saints ruling together in God's kingdom and all the bounty that will come. And that last day, we're not totally sure what it's about, but we know it's such beautiful things where the rest of the world becomes a part of God's plan. And there's humans involved all the way along, humans turning in to God's family, into spirit beings. But on the Day of Atonement, not so much. It's not about us. It's about a being, and we watch, and we certainly come out of the world at that point, but it's not about us. God has his own story going. God has a large, huge, important, detailed history going that we know nothing about. We're only a part of it on earth. We're only a part of it. We're a big part of it because we're what he wants. You know, it says in Ephesians, he's doing all this because he wants to. It's according to his pleasure and his will that God has decided to expand his family. He wants other beings around. You know, it started, one of the reasons that we think of God as being twofold, you know, God and Jesus Christ, is that there's a relationship there. There's a loving relationship. And God wants to expand that. And of course, that's the story of his plan and his holy days. And you're privileged to know about that. But there is a whole other story going on. And when you think about it, it's been going on for eternity, trillions of years, possibly. I have no idea how many. I'm just, as you say, Montana, I'm just woofing on that. I have no idea. But there were many things that happened for eons and eons before the first human ever existed, before God breathed the breath of life into Adam. The story, by the way, intersects with our story on the Day of Atonement. And that's what our role in it is. The story is not far away from us. This is important. You know, we picture God, I think there's a scripture that talks about his throne being in the north, and we picture God as being far away. But for all we know, God's place where he lives is right here. We have senses that can only detect certain things, that can only detect, I think, what we call four dimensions. But there could be other things going on around us right now that we have no concept of because we can't sense them in any way. And so in that sense, they do happen far away. But remember in the Old Testament, in 2 Kings, there was a story with Elisha, and his servant was very worried because there was an army surrounding them. And Elisha said, God, please open this man's eyes so he can see what you're really doing. And God opened that man's eyes, and he saw that there are more for us than there are against us, that God's army was standing there, and it was huge. And we have no idea how large the extent of God's spirit involvement in our world is because we can't see it and we can't detect it. But it's going on right now. And the reason that army could be right there is that, you know, it's not that they're far away. God is near us at all times, but we can't see the things that he's doing. And there are times in the history of mankind where God says to people, that's my business, not yours. There are times when God says that. Let's turn to Genesis 15. Genesis 15 is a story in itself because it's God talking to Abraham and God teaching Abraham through certain sacrifices that sound very strange to us. It's a very strange story with deep sleeps and thick and dreadful darkness and lights traveling between animals that have been cut in half and stood up against each other and promises being made to Abraham. But all I want to point out at this point is that in chapter 15 of Genesis and in 12, verse 12, it starts, God lets Abraham know something. He says, as the sun was setting, Abram fell into a deep sleep, and a thick and dreadful darkness came over him. Then the Lord said to him, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. So there's a story to take place, and God, his invisible spirit beings, will guide this into happening somehow. You, in verse 15, you, however, will go to your fathers in peace and be buried at a good old age. And what he's saying to Abraham is life will go on. You and I have this great relationship, but you're just a small part in a big world, and you will die, and your descendants will be the important ones at that point. But then, in verse 16, he says something very curious. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. And you wonder, you know, could God have done things at a different time? Could God have made the Israelites come back to Israel at a different time? And the answer is yes, he could. One of the things that happened in Egypt was that Israel grew into a great nation, millions of people. And so he used that as a place for them to grow. But he says that the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure. Now, if you look down in verse 19 and 20 and 21, God lists all the people who are living in what we call the Promised Land, and there's various tribes, and one of them is the Amorites. But God has singled out the Amorites and said, they have some ripening to do themselves. Their story has to move on too. And it's not something that we know about or that Abram knew about, but it was part of God's story. And God basically says, you know, you'll be fine. You'll go to your fathers in peace, but my story will go on. And what do we know about the Amorites? Well, interestingly enough, the Amorites are one of the tribes that we can find things about in history outside of the Bible, in archaeology, in the British Museum, in records. The Amorites, it's a little unclear because there seem to be various places where they popped up from time to time and influenced history. But the Amorites, you remember when Joshua was and the Israelites were conquering the Promised Land, there was Sion, king of the Amorites, and Og, king of Bashan, both of whom had connections with the giants, with the Rephaim. And we know that the Rephaim story, whatever it is, it's a little difficult for us to understand, but it is connected with evil in some ways, with evil spirits. And it's not God's friends who are making all this happen. Well, what God is saying is that there are things going on. There are things going on with another story, and it's not necessarily a pleasant one, or it's not one that is in tune with my way of life. But I let evil unfold on the earth, and the story of the Amorites has to develop to a certain point. The Amorites are actually connected with the founding of a small village in the Middle East, which was named Babylon. And it grew into, of course, a mighty kingdom 1,000-plus years later, and plays a great story literally in God's plan and also figuratively, because Babylon has come to picture the operations of evil on earth. And the Amorites are connected with that somehow. But the main point I want to make is God is saying, that's my business. I have things going on and they don't involve you. When you turn to the book of Daniel, we know that God outlines for Daniel the rest of history from that point on because of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And we don't need to cover that specifically, but you remember there was a great statue. And the statue represented Babylon, and the Greeks and the Persians, and finally the Roman Empire down at the feet. I was doing it the wrong direction. And what God is saying there is that the forces of evil will play out in history, and that those kingdoms have to take place, and they're not inspired by me. They're not my kingdoms. You know, when Satan was offering the kingdoms of the world to Jesus Christ, he was saying, I've had a hand in all this. And that's what God also echoes. But in Daniel 12, after all the things that God has said to Daniel, and Daniel, no one was as righteous as Daniel. He's praised in a couple places in Ezekiel as being one of the most righteous men that ever existed. And God had a very close relationship with him. And you know, God gave Daniel information that he couldn't have gotten any other way, that saved his own life and the lives of his companions and helped the nation of Israel to be preserved. And he gave him all kinds of information that's valuable to us in the end times because it hasn't taken place yet. And so God loved Daniel and respected Daniel and took care of Daniel, and Daniel obeyed God. They were very close. They were very good friends. I wish I could be as close to God as Daniel was. But what does God say in chapter 12 of Daniel? He talks about, in chapter 12, about that time, Michael, the great prince who protects your people, will arise. So there will be spirit meddling in the affairs of men at that point. There will be angels fighting. And you know, an angel did come to Daniel after Daniel had prayed and prayed and prayed for information and understanding. The angel said, look, I would have been here earlier, but I've been busy. He said, I've been fighting. I'm tired. I have to go back and fight. I have to fight the prince of Persia. And you know, we think, what's going on? We don't know. We know about Persia rising, but we don't know anything about angels fighting other than those little mentions of it. So Daniel was given all kinds of information, but he was also told at the time that there are other things going on that are my business and not necessarily yours. Because, of course, we don't want to intersect with the kingdom of evil. We're to be in the world, but not of the world. And in Daniel 12, then God tells him all kinds of other things and details, and they're things that we discuss today and try to understand what they would be. And Daniel says in verse 8, because Daniel, for all his with-it-ness, Daniel a lot of times got to say, I have no idea what you're talking about. Would you explain this to me? And that's what he says in verse 8 of chapter 12. He says, I heard, but I did not understand. So I asked, my Lord, what will the outcome of all this be? In other words, I know every word that you've said to me, but I can't string them together so they make sense. Will you please explain it? And God instead of saying, here's what's going to happen, like he did before, in verse 12, delivers a different message from God. He says, go your way, Daniel, because the words are closed up and sealed until the end. Many will be purified, made spotless and refined, but the wicked will continue to be wicked. None of the wicked will understand, but those who are wise will understand. And then he gives him more information. And then in verse 13, he says, as for you, go your way till the end. You will rest. And then at the end of the days, you will rise to receive your allotted inheritance. So not unkind, but at the same time, still saying, I have a story going on and you're a small part of it. Your life, you know, we'll go on for a while, you will die, and then you will rise, and you will have been a blessed and important part of my story, but there's much bigger things going on than you. We know in the New Testament that Jesus Christ, one of the last things he says to his disciples in the book of Acts is, it's not for you to know the days or the hours. You know, I give you the basic information, but I don't give it all to you because we have other things going on. One of the reasons, of course, that he couldn't give it to them was because he didn't know. He said that only his Father knew that information. But then in John 21, when John is winding up his writings, other gospels end with people saying, go you into the world, do this, do that, and Jesus ascending and things like that. But John ends it with a little vignette with just three men walking on the beach. Two of them are together talking to each other, which is Jesus and Peter, and a third person, John, who refers to himself only as the disciple whom Jesus loved, is walking behind. And Jesus gives information to Peter that's to give him clues about his own role in things. And in verse 20, Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved was following them. This was the one who had leaned back against Jesus, et cetera, et cetera. He's identifying himself. And in verse 21, Peter says, Lord, what about him? And there might have been a little bit of rivalry going there. I mean, John was clearly beloved of Jesus, but Peter was clearly a honcho in the organization. Peter, Peter had had his own intersection with evil. Jesus told him, and talk about a scary thing. Peter said, Satan wanted to sift you. Said, Satan wanted to do things to you, but I am praying for you that your faith will stand, and that when you're all done with that, that you'll emerge stronger and that you'll help your brethren. He did say that. That's a very scary thing to think about. But he also gave him the hope that he would win, that he would resist, and that he would come back and help his brethren. So Peter knew that he had a place with Jesus. I mean, Jesus had just asked him 3 times, do you love me? Try that with your friends sometime if you want to make the situation uncomfortable. But Peter says, well, what about that guy? Jesus answered in verse 22, if I want him to remain until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me. In other words, you do what you do. He'll do what he does. I'll do what I do. There's some things you know, some things you don't know. And that was a little bit of being put in his place. And the rumor went around that John wasn't going to die till Jesus returned, but he didn't say that. John addresses that. John spent so much time in his writings not identifying himself, and it turns out that he keeps being identified, and he's one of the people closest to Jesus. But the point is that God is consistent there. He's saying there's another story going on, and you play a part in the whole thing, but this part has nothing to do with you. It's not about us. Part of the story that we only know a little bit about, and Mr. Thomas went through he went through everything that we could go through on the Day of Atonement. He taught us well, is that in God's life and in God's plan, long before there were ever humans, there was a particularly magnificent being, a spectacular servant of God for whom God had great hopes. And let's turn to Ezekiel 28. Of course, there's also references to this in Isaiah. And Ezekiel 28 is scriptures that were covered on the Day of Atonement. But we can see how much this being meant to God. Ezekiel 28, starting in verse 12. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. And Greg went into detail about why we know this is talking about Satan. And our publications do that. It is talking about that enemy. I'm just going to say that. I'm not going to try to prove that at this point. But in verse 12, it starts out by saying, you were the model of perfection, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. It makes you think that he was saved till close to the end because he was created. He was a created being, but by then, God already knew what perfection was to the point where he could make someone perfect. He wanted a servant of that caliber. He had Michael, he had Gabriel, he had others that we don't know by name. But this was a very special being whose name we're still a little hazy on. We don't really know. Satan is a title. He's the accuser. Lucifer is a light bringer. There's a morning star, things like that. But we don't really know the name. God knew his name. You were in Eden. And as Greg explained, that was an Eden in God's heaven, the garden of God. Every precious stone adorned you, ruby, topaz, emerald, chrysolite, onyx, jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and beryl. And actually, some of those are just stabs at what those stones were. We don't know what all of them were. Your settings and mountings were made of gold. On the day you were prepared, you were created, they were prepared. You were anointed as a guardian cherub, for so I ordained you. You were on the holy mount of God, and you walked among the fiery stones. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created. That's God's handiwork. He had made a blameless being till wickedness was found in you. And of course, that was the doing of that being himself. This was someone who meant a great deal to God. It's interesting what those precious stones set in gold, because that sounds an awful lot like the ephod that the priest of God wore. The priest of God wore a gold garment that had stones set in it. It's described a little bit differently from that, but they're both very unusual outfits, and they're both very similar, extremely similar. And you know, when Jesus, the high priest, of course, was picturing our Lord Jesus Christ, Yahweh who made the earth. That's what the high priest was picturing. And you wonder what the importance of that breastplate was, since it's so similar to this which was on that created being. When Jesus Christ reveals things to John in Revelation, one of the things we know is that he's wearing gold around his chest. And it makes us wonder if it's that kind of ephod. You know, it doesn't mention the stones, but it does mention that he's wearing a special garment. And I can't tell you exactly what the connection is, but that's how close this being was to God, was that there were enough similarities that way. Then something happened. It seems like it has to do with us. It seems like that Satan realized that he had a part to play in the story, and he became unhappy with that. And one of the clues that we have to that is in the book of Job, where Job's friend is talking. And of course, in Job 1, Satan is mentioned as still talking to God and still being part of the story. But in Job, what is it, Job? Job 4, and verses 17 to 21. This is not Satan or God talking. This is Job's friend, Eliphaz, talking. And he's talking about an experience he had where a spirit stood at the foot of his bed and gave him a message. Not the kind of thing you usually talk about over coffee. This is weird. And yet the spirit said some very important things and let out some kind of secrets that maybe the person in charge of him wouldn't have wanted us to know, but we know them and they're preserved. And it says in verse 16 of Job 4, a form stood before my eyes and I heard a hushed voice. Can a mortal be more righteous than God? And of course, Satan wasn't a mortal, nor was the being saying this. It's talking about people. And it has to do with Job's situation, but it has to do with mankind in general. Can a man be more pure than his maker? Because these spirit beings are well aware of our shortcomings, that we were created lower than the angels, and that we were born to sin, basically. We were born to reject God. I mean, God didn't plan it that way, and he didn't want it that way, but that's the human story. It says in verse 18, if God places no trust in his servants, and if he charges his angels with error, how much more those who live in houses of clay, whose foundations are in the dust, who are crushed more readily than a moth? That's what the spirit world thinks of you, or what the evil spirit world thinks of you. Between dawn and dusk, they are broken to pieces. They come and go quickly. They don't live anywhere near as long as we do. Unnoticed, they perish forever. Are not the cords of their tents pulled up so that they die without wisdom? In other words, when you die, you don't know much more than when you were born. It's a short experience. Well, what a depressing way of looking at the human life. We know that it's much more uplifting than that, but this gives us a clue. We know that Satan disobeyed at some point. Jesus said he was a murderer from the beginning and the father of lies. And we don't know exactly what happened, but at some point we do know that he decided to do a rebellion and to take over. And he wanted to be seated on the throne himself. And this is one of the ways he justified it, by saying, well, God's making these people, but we've made mistakes and God cast us down. God found out about this rebellion and Satan fell like lightning. These were his grievances, you know, that he said, you know, you will forgive. By the time people were created, he said, you will forgive them, but you won't forgive us. But they can't be more righteous than you. So there was a lot of discontent there. And in some ways, I think that his main power, of course, we call him the prince of the power of the air, and he does have other powers. But his main power these days seems to me to be able to use his own griefs and grievances to resonate with ours and to amplify ours and put them in the foremost part of our brain and to keep thinking about them and to subtly have us turn against what we know is right and true and pursue what seems like freedom. That was his point in the Garden of Eden. Anyway, he was cast out and he fell. In Luke, Jesus said, I saw Satan fall like lightning. Just clearly, he says that. And it had to be before the creation week in Genesis 1. Even though we know that Satan will be cast out again, according to Revelation, there are many events going on, and we will understand them all clearly someday. We do understand a lot of them at this point. But it seems like his falling was related to the destruction of the earth and the that made it formless and void that needed to be recreated in Genesis 1. And I realize this is covering an epic tale, and I'm doing it very shortly. But it seems to be linked to that, and it talks about Leviathan, and again, Leviathan seems to represent a real flesh and blood creature in the Bible, but also a home for a spirit creature. And it talks about him being set down and his head crushed after he fell, and his body was given as food in the desert. And so there was a rebellion and a crushing of the rebellion at that point. And we've come to accept that the earth was destroyed and God recreated it. And that's the inspirational part, that God at that point used what Satan had done to fit into his story and turn it to his advantage. But then, you know, the weirdest thing happens between Satan being thrown down, and it seems like perhaps he was cast into the abyss then, because that's what God did. The spirits who rebelled, they go into an outer darkness. That's the abyss that the demons beg Jesus not to send them back into. That's where God keeps the prisoners at that point. We don't know if Satan was there, but we know that he disappeared for a short time. But then only a matter of days later, there's a being in the garden again. What happened in between that? We don't know. It's very strange. But there must have been some kind of second chance given there, where Satan would be confined to earth, and yet he would have access to the apple of God's eye, human beings. Because he was there in the garden, and he was allowed to talk with them. And there was some agreement made there, you know. Maybe that's what Satan lied about when Jesus said he was the father of lies, because the things he said in the Garden of Eden, you could construe as saying, well, he was right about that. I mean, he was wrong about God's intentions and about God's purpose, but maybe Satan lied to God at that point. Maybe the second chance was given, but Satan never really meant to follow through. And I realize these are things that we could discuss. I'm not telling you things that are set in scriptural stone. I'm telling you things to make you think and make you wonder and make you marvel at the greatness of God and his own story. So he's back. Something has been worked out. We know that four times in the New Testament, the law is referred to as being given, the law of punishment, of blood and things, has been given at the behest of angels through a mediator, which was Jesus Christ. But the law that was given at Mount Sinai to the Israelites was delivered by God himself. That was the whole point. We don't have the record of how the angels come into it. But you wonder if Satan, like this being in Job 4, didn't say, well, you know, you treated us a certain way, you better treat them the same way. And so, regardless of why it came about, you know, there were laws given, and blood did have to be paid for with blood, and there were punishments, and it's only God's grace, and we know through the events of the holy days how God helps us out of that mire. But again, Satan goes on to live and operate for thousands of years. There's those kingdoms. There's Babylon. There's Greece, there's Persia, there's Rome. We know that by the time of Job, that Satan was hobnobbing with the good guys, with God, that he was just talking to him casually. Something had been worked out. In the wilderness, where Jesus goes after he's been baptized and is tempted by Satan in the wilderness, Jesus doesn't seem surprised or that upset by it. Of course, he knows what's going on. But he talks to Satan very openly, and I don't want to say casually, because there was a lot at stake there, but they could just have a normal conversation. Satan was allowed to do these things. There's another story going on that we only see where it surfaces here and there. He is punished, he's confined to the earth, and by this time, God has figured something out, and I hesitate to even say this because it's given to us in code in Leviticus 16, with the goats and things. The whole story of what God's doing with Satan is that God uses Satan in his own and humanity's best interests. In our resisting, like Peter tells us to do, he says that Satan is a roaring lion and we must resist him. And remember, Peter had some resisting of his own to do, that Jesus said, Satan will sift you, but your faith will be strong and you'll come back. Well, Peter gave the same advice to us. He said, resist, and that's what we do. We resist, we resist, we resist. Now, we need God's help to do that. Because there are, as I said, I think it's more the evil, the danger of the world of evil is the thoughts that are planted in our mind of doubt and disappointment, which Mr. Mango told us how to deal with. But the point is that his story keeps coming up and up. But we must remember that this is a mighty being, that he was beloved. I use that word because God really placed a lot of goodwill towards him, beloved and respected by God. And in his story, there are at least three second chances. He reappeared in the Garden of Eden after some kind of rebellion. That's one second chance. We should also, there's another second chance that comes later, of course. I wonder what the third one was. I can only think of two at this point. Well, it gave me something to think about afterwards. But while we recognize him as the enemy and resisting him, we should still at the same time respect what God has made and think of him who was once a great and noble servant of God. And just as David spared Saul on two occasions, Saul, who was his enemy, Saul, who had turned against God, and Saul, who was literally trying to kill David, and yet David on two occasions spared Saul's life, we should remember Satan with the respect and the care that God created him with. We shouldn't put down our guard or anything like that. But that should be part of the story. Back in 1986, the man who was we sometimes refer to him as the founder of the Worldwide Church of God, Herbert Armstrong, died. He was replaced by a man named Joseph Tocat. And Joseph Tocat basically, with other people, oversaw the dismantling of the organization of God's church at that point. Nowadays, you know, we gave him the benefit of the doubt in those days. Now we can see a little more clearly what happened there. But one of the reasons that I began to suspect Joseph Tocat very early on, besides the fact that he was our neighbor in Pasadena, and I always wondered what was going on in his mind, like anything, but one of the things that he said early on was he talked about a man coming to his desk, and he said that Satan was operating through this man. And he said, so the way I would deal with that is I would just jump over the desk and whoop him. And I thought, that's not the way a servant of God talks. Do you understand anything? And of course, as time went on, it turns out he didn't understand anything and that he was a tool in other people's hands. But his disrespect for God's creation in the form of Satan at that point was one of the first clues to me. And it turned out that not just I, but thousands of other people were right about that, that he wasn't the good person to be in charge at that point. Anyway, all this goes on, and by the time we get to Revelation 20, we see a being who was once loved and respected and who now, in a way, is mourned. It's a solemn time. It's a time that God is putting him away in a bottomless pit. And I wonder if you've thought about it, but at the time, you won't be fasting. You'll be spirit beings. Or if you are fasting, I mean, you probably will be fasting, but it won't matter to you. You'll be spirit beings. You're not people who need to eat or drink at that point. You'll already be part of God's family. He will already have given you full spirit life at that point. And yet you'll be standing there observing it. I wonder if everybody on earth will see it. And the reason I wonder is there's no place on earth for a bottomless pit. We could argue about that. And I'll have fun doing it if you want to. But bottomless, no bottom, there's no place on earth where you could have a pit that truly had no bottom. You could say, well, maybe it's just poetry, but it's a bottomless pit, and it's something that a spirit being could be locked in. And what I'm thinking is perhaps there's an opening in our world that people could see, and this is all just speculation and trying to figure it out on my part, that opens into another world of outer darkness. Again, it's that abyss that the demons beg Jesus not to throw them in, and it's what Peter calls the outer darkness. You know, if there's some kind of prison there, it seems to derive them of all sensory perception, and they basically just go nuts while they're in there. But at this time, God, in a way, is letting go. God's saying it's over. And Satan still has a role to play, but things have changed from that point on. God has kind of said goodbye to him, and his people are with him, and we stand with him in solidarity. Does he need us? Well, no. But if he doesn't want us, and if he doesn't need us, what is he doing all this for? What is he doing raising children? I mean, in a way, you could say that we're God's weakness. It's wrong for me to talk about weaknesses with God, but we're kind of that. He has a soft spot for us. And the reason he's gone to all this trouble is because he loves us, and he loves the idea of having a family, and he wants us there. The day isn't about us. By this time, we are God's family. We have resisted and overcome by his grace, and God has trusted us enough to give us full spirit powers. We can do things that God can't do. And what I mean by that, I mean, people have taken me to task for saying that. What I mean by that is we think of things that God doesn't come up with. That's one of the reasons he made us. He made us to be creative. He made us to do more as a family with him at the head than he could do on his own. He wants to give us those powers and see what we do with them. And so when I say things that he can't do, well, God could do any of them, but they're not things that maybe God would have thought of doing at that point. So he has beings who aren't him. That's the whole point, that there are other beings who aren't him. And if you don't have the ability to operate independently, then you're nothing but an iPhone in his hand, frankly, that he's punching buttons on. What God wants is people with Christ living in them, who will live his way and who will do magnificent things at that point. You know, your children grow up, and for a while, of course, you could say you've created them. We certainly didn't invent the process, but we create our children. And then for a while, you have the input, and you teach them, and you give them laws, and you give them rules, and you teach them to be like you and or not like you, depending. And you guide them and you choose things for them. But then at a certain point, you begin to realize that you're not the big influence in their life anymore. It's a big day of reckoning for parents to realize that their friends and other poles of the world are shaping them now as much as you are. But one of the great satisfactions is to see children who are grown up, whom you've tried to point in the right direction. You know, as God says, teach a child in the way he should go. And to have them grown up and functioning on their own and doing things that you couldn't do and that you never thought of doing, and maybe like making 3 times more money than you ever did and doing just fine, thank you. But it's a great satisfaction. And in Psalm 127, we sing this as, unless the Lord shall build the house, God talks about this. In Psalm 127 and verse 3, he says, sons are a heritage from the Lord, children are a reward from him. Like arrows in the hands of a warrior are sons born in one's youth. Blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be put to shame when they contend with their enemies in the gate. Well, that may have been true in society back then. I don't think of my children that way. I don't think of them as weapons in my quiver who will stand with me at the gate with my enemies. But think about it from the terms of the Day of Atonement, that God is putting his enemy away and his quiver full of people, thousands and thousands, maybe millions, who knows, are standing there with him. On the Day of Atonement, God asks us to put the earth aside and to be part of his world and his story. And so we do it in a feeble way now. We do it by not eating or drinking, because those are earthly things. We abandon those. We don't have the relations with our spouses, because that's so much part of the world. I personally turn off my electronics because I don't want to be part of that. I don't want to be linked to the world. I don't want to be reading news. I got in trouble doing that when we were in Australia a few years ago, because we had the worst Day of Atonement we'd ever had. It was really excruciating. And the next morning, we were so happy that we went to breakfast and we ordered a fantastic breakfast. And I put it on Facebook because I turned my phone back on. It wasn't the Day of Atonement anymore. Well, people back in Ohio, we're still keeping the Day of Atonement, and there's my breakfast right in front of them. I heard about that, and I thought to myself, well, what are you doing on Facebook on the Day of Atonement? But it's just something to think about, is that we don't eat or drink because that ties us to earth. I fast literally to be close to God, and not just in some vague way, but to be literally close to him, to be in his story and in his world. And then the Day of Atonement becomes something beautiful, something comforting, something important, that we can have an impact on the story of the universe and more by standing with our Creator. That our fasting and our having a convocation isn't about us. It shows that we stand with God as he contemplates and lives through a story of this incredible being that he created and loved. It makes keeping the Day of Atonement a privilege and a family honor and a chance to make God's power even stronger. It's about giving, and it makes me look forward to it instead of just being a hurdle between us and the Feast of Tabernacles, like I sometimes have looked at these things. The Day of Atonement stands as a beautiful thing in its own right. Just as I am a hurdle between you and a potluck. And now, by the powers that were never ever invested in me, I declare the second Day of Atonement over.